Recent Developments in Physics, Some Implications for Theology by Robert C. Newman. Instead of an abstract, we will go right into the introduction, which gives a sketch of what we're going to do. We want to look at several phenomena in physics discovered in the 20th century: the quantum world, relativity theory, the question of the open versus closed universe, and chaos theory. So let's begin, first of all, with the quantum world. Here we want to give a quick tour of quantum phenomena, namely the photoelectric effect, the discrete energy levels in atoms and nuclei, and the matter of wave-particle duality. The photoelectric effect had been known since sometime in the 19th century, but was explained right near the end of the century. The photoelectric effect basically is this: that when light is shown, particularly ultraviolet light, is shown on the surface of metal, then the metal gives off electrons. Depending on what metal you're shining it on, the electrons are only given off if the frequency of light is above some minimum threshold. That was a little bit surprising in view of the wave nature of light. But then even more surprising, if the frequency of the light is above this minimum threshold, then electrons come off even with a very weak beam of light, though in fact the number of electrons that come off are proportional to the strength of the beam, the intensity of the beam, we'll call it. The upshot of this, as theorists thought about this, is that metals apparently absorb light in packets, or quanta. So this was the first suggestion for nearly a century, that light was not just a wave, that there was something more going on there than that. Newton had thought that light was a particle of some sort, but he gave it, to fit some of the phenomena, a little sort of wave character, but that had disappeared in the 19th century by and large. As time went on, as we come into the 20th century, begin to realize that this was not only true of metals, but atoms and nuclei in general do not absorb or emit light in just any frequencies or wavelengths, but rather a particular type of atom or nucleus, say hydrogen atom or carbon atom or something, or nucleus, will absorb or emit a discrete series of frequencies, depending on kind of representing different energy states, so to speak. As that was thought through, it became apparent then that the atoms or nuclei exist in a series of energy levels or steps, and as they go up or down from one level to another, one step to another, they either emit coming down or absorb going up light of the difference between the two energy levels. And so became apparent then that this whole question of how energy is absorbed and emitted with atoms was something that in general occurred in discrete steps. As we come into the 20th century, further into the 20s, it was suggested that light does not then exist just as waves, as had been earlier thought, but rather it behaves sometimes as a wave and sometimes as a particle. Louis de Broglie then suggested that the same was true for objects that had traditionally been thought of as particles, that is for electrons and protons, etc., that they seem under some conditions to be waves and under some conditions to be particles, and that light seems under some conditions to be waves and some conditions to be particles. The theory that was developed in the 20th century to explain these phenomena, the phenomena of the photoelectric effect and discrete energy levels and the wave-particle duality, came to be known as quantum theory. and the objects in quantum theory, that is, the particles or waves or whatever you want to call them, are described by means of a wave function. And this was felt then as the theory was developed to be a wave of probability or potentiality that tells where the object is likely to be, rather than telling you exactly where it is. When the object interacts with another object, then the wave function describing each of these objects, if you like, collapses. And we can imagine something like that with a probability function. You can imagine that the probability function for flipping a fair coin is half heads and half tails, and you flip the coin, and when the coin lands, the probability collapses to 1 for the side that is up and 0 for the side that is down, if you like. Well, something seemed to be happening like that. Well, the question, of course, was developed at that time and has continued since, the question of how realistic is quantum theory? And it is clearly partly an epistemological effect. We are now beginning to look, when we get into quantum matter, we are beginning to look at size scales where the observational tools we have disrupt the structure we're looking at. To look at smaller and smaller size scales, you need radiation, let's say light, we'll call it that, of smaller and smaller wavelengths. And as the wavelength of light gets smaller, the energy gets larger, and you eventually reach the place where the energies that are involved in the light is big enough to disrupt the structure you're looking at. So it's somewhat like trying to investigate the inside of a china shop in the dark, throwing baseballs around the room, if you like. It will give you some information on where things are when you hear them crash, but it disrupts what they are somewhat. Well, the disruption is somewhat different on the quantum scale. It's largely moving things out of the way, but it does also involve changing the structure of things somewhat. But quantum theory is dealing with some phenomena that are more than just an epistemological effect. The light apparently really is in quanta, and you have the peculiar two-slit experiment and the EPR paradox, the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox, and we'll say a word or two about each of those. The two-slit experiment is one that takes place when you imagine that you're shining light on a screen. If you shine a light on a screen with nothing in between them, just empty space, then you basically get uniform illumination of the screen, or falls off with the square or the distance as you go out from the nearest part of the screen to where your light source is. But suppose now you put between the light and the screen another screen with a pair of slits in it, so that light can only reach the back screen by passing through the pair of slits. If you do that, the light which is passed through the pair of slits produces what we call an interference pattern. That is the what you see on the back screen, the one farthest from the light source, and it's got the two slits between it and the source. Now, instead of having a rather uniform illumination which falls off somewhat as you get away from the closest part of the screen to the source, forms a pattern of light and dark bands, if you like. And these bands come from the idea that you're looking at two sources, the two slits, and the slits are interfering with each other as they reach the back screen. They are reinforcing each other in some places and making a light spot or line, actually. And in other places, they are interfering with one another and producing a dark line, if you like. Now, suppose you turn down the intensity of the light in your source so that, on the basis of quantum mechanics, it looks like only one quantum is passing from the source to a screen at a time. you would expect, you know, that the interference would disappear because the light would have nothing to interfere with. But no, you still get the pattern. It takes a while to build up the pattern because the light is so dim at that point. But if you have the back screen having some kind of receptors like a photographic plate or some kind of detectors like we would use now in a digital camera or something of that sort, you'll still get the pattern. And the question naturally arises, well, since there was only one quantum at a time coming from the source to the screen, which slit did the quantum go through? And if you close one slit, you destroy the pattern, okay? If you put a detector at one slit to try and detect whether the light went through that one or not, you destroy the pattern. So in some sense, it looks like the quantum of light knows about both slits. Well, that's an experiment you can actually do, and there it is. So that's not something that's strictly an epistemological thing. That's something that's very metaphysical, if you like, very real, if you like, strange as it is. The Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen, or EPR paradox, is even stranger. If two particles have interacted, think of two electrons having interacted, or electron and a positron coming out from a pair production or something of that sort, then the quantum states of these two particles are correlated with each other. So the spins, if you like, of the two particles are related to one another, one up and one down or something of that sort. If an observer then measures the state of one of the particles, say whether the spin is up or down, or whether the spin is to the right or left or something of that sort, somehow the other particle knows, and we probably should put quotes around knows what the measurement was, even if they're so far apart that a signal could not have gotten there yet. Are these instantaneous effects at a distance? Or is there really something about nature that is non-local? And a number of different proposals have been made to try and understand something of this sort. And I guess we have to say at the moment that there's not a clear agreement on that particular question. Even understanding quantum phenomena themselves have led to diverse models to explain the quantum phenomena. There's agreement on what the phenomena are, and a theory has been constructed that explains the phenomena very well, but the question is, what is behind the phenomenon? And these diverse models are the Copenhagen interpretation, the mind over matter interpretation, the many worlds interpretation, the neorealist interpretation, and the undivided wholeness interpretation. We want to take a quick look at each of these. The Copenhagen interpretation is the view of Bohr and Heisenberg, and it is the prevailing one in physics today, though not unanimous by any means. The Copenhagen interpretation says that there really is no deep reality in the absence of measurement, only potentialities. And so these potentiality waves or probability waves are the reality in some sense. But that when a measurement is made, that collapses the wave function so that the potentialities then become specific actualities, which are part of the range of the potential possibilities before that has happened. This, however, has a rather huge problem of how you transition from the micro world to the macro world, since although these things are going on the micro level, obviously real things are happening in the macro world. A number of rather strange experiments have been suggested as well. You might look, do a Google search on Schrödinger's cat to see something of that sort there. We'll mention that here in our next panel, actually. The second model interpretation, if you like, is mind over matter interpretation. This is the view of Wigner and von Neumann. And here the idea is that it's not the measurement that collapses the wave function. It's a conscious observer that collapses the wave function. and that consciousness is necessary for the universe to exist. Well, that certainly sounds extremely strange, although it might fit idealistic philosophy, the idea that there's a mind that has conceived this universe, and that the universe exists in some sense in idealism only in the mind of the of this consciousness, etc. But that is not a very popular idea these days, where in some sense you might say the unofficial orthodoxy of science is materialism, and materialism has no place for consciousness that is more basic than that which is evolved in the history of the universe. There's, of course, even in this model, a problem of the transition to consciousness. Humans are conscious, that's fairly clear. Are animals conscious? Are bugs conscious? Are plants conscious? And therefore, do animals and bugs and plants collapse the wave function in connection with them? This thought experiment called Schrödinger's cat kind of falls in this category as well. You imagine that you have a cat inside a closed container of some sort, and inside that container you have got a vial of, say, cyanide gas, and a device that will break the vial of cyanide gas if, a particular atom decays, or maybe if it's struck by a cosmic ray. So some kind of quantum phenomena may or may not break this vial. And the question then is, when does the wave function collapse? Does the wave function collapse when the atom does or does not decay, or does decay, let's say, or when the cosmic ray hits the detector? Or does the wave function only collapse when the observer looks in the box to see whether Schrödinger's cat is still alive? Strange phenomenon. The many worlds interpretation is the view of Everett and Davies, Hugh Everett and Paul Davies. In this view, there is no collapse of the wave function. Instead, all of the possibilities that are given by the wave function are, what should we say, actualized by a multiplication of universes. Each alternative is manifested in some universe. So the number of universes multiplies and multiplies every time we get a situation in which we've got a multiplicity of possible outcomes. Huge problem here with conservation laws. conservation of matter, well, you've got multiplying universes with all the matter in those universes, etc. If nothing is conserved between universes, why is anything conserved within them? Strange. Neorealist interpretation is the view of Einstein, Planck, Schrödinger, and Bohm. The world is made of objects that actually possess attributes, whether we observe them or not. Lots of us feel rather comfortable with a realist interpretation of some sort. But given the phenomena of quantum mechanics, these attributes are going to have to be rather strange ones, much stranger than most of us by common sense would normally expect. There's also the undivided wholeness interpretation, view of Bohm and F. Capra. In this view, the world is a seamless whole. The various variables have real values, but locality is abandoned. The togetherness of various particles and phenomena is undiminished by distance, which again goes very much against the common sense interpretation, where things like inverse square law and such make seem to be the more reasonable way of thinking about things. Well, those are the five approaches: the Copenhagen interpretation, the mind over matter interpretation, the many worlds interpretation, the neorealist interpretation, and the undivided wholeness interpretation. What can we say in summary on the quantum world? Well, it's certainly strange. We can say that. We can see now that the old ideas of particle contact, that that's the way things happen, or of fields and waves, were in fact research programs rather than the way things are. Both of those have now encountered contradictory evidence. But it's not at all obvious what the deep reality is actually like. So on that unsatisfactory note, we leave the quantum world and come over to think about relativity. Like quantum phenomena, relativistic phenomena seem to mock at common sense. The discussion of relativity is usually divided into two pieces, special relativity and general relativity, in accordance with Einstein's initial theory of special relativity, which was then generalized to form the general theory of relativity some years later. In special relativity, the main phenomena are that as a particle moves faster and faster, it becomes harder and harder to speed it up, and it appears that it would take an infinite amount of energy to make that particle go faster than what we call the speed of light. That's the speed of light in a vacuum. As we speed up an object, and here we're thinking more of a macroscopic object rather than a microscopic one, I suppose, the length of that object as we observe it, as we are the stationary observer watching this thing move, goes towards zero length as the velocity approaches that of the velocity of light. As we increase the speed of this object, and this will work okay now with elementary particles, the mass of that object increases and approaches infinity as the velocity of the particle approaches the speed of light. And if we think about how time is passing in connection with this object as we observe it, okay, not necessarily as someone riding with the object might observe it, as the speed of light approaches infinity, the time seems to slow up until it would be standing still as you are going at the speed of light. That is, the time slows down. Now, the interesting thing here is that we have had a good deal of experience now since World War II with particle accelerators, devices in which we can make electrons and protons and such move faster and faster by various techniques. And we can in fact show that we do have a mass increase. We do have what appears to be an absolute speed limit, and we do have time dilation, which we can measure in terms of the half-life of unstable particles. So these phenomena are quite obviously there, and in fact we have to take them into account to build particle accelerators as well. The results of all of this are that we are unable to specify an absolute frame of reference. We can compare how things are moving relative to where to what we're doing, and but if we're moving, if we then accelerate to move to a higher speed, etc., then the other object will not seem to be moving as fast relative to us, or it might be seen to be moving faster depending on the other direction. But it's not like the frame of reference problem you have in Newtonian mechanics where you can just add the speeds, but again you get this maximum speed limit, if you like, the speed of light. The upshot of that then is the relativity of space and time intervals. That in special relativity, for two objects moving relative to one another, you can specify certain events that are simultaneous in your frame of reference, but they won't be simultaneous in the frame of this other object moving relative to you. And so you get relativity of time intervals and also relativity of space intervals as well. Well, in fact, the relativity of space and time intervals actually follows logically from the absolute speed of light in a vacuum for all observers, if you actually work out the mathematics here. And relativity actually unpacks a contradiction between Newton's equations for of motion and Maxwell's equations for electromagnetism. it becomes apparent that these two sets of equations are not consistent with one another, and so one must be right and the other is wrong. And after some work with it, it becomes apparent it's Newton's equations of motion that are mistaken, and they have to be adjusted as speeds get large. So Newton's equations work well at low speeds, but as your speeds approach the speed of light, they become inaccurate, if you like. That's special relativity. General relativity. General relativity is an attempt to generalize the results of special relativity by including acceleration. General relativity is just thought in terms of constant motion between two frames of two frames relative to one another. But general relativity attempts to incorporate acceleration as well. Both special and general relativity worked out by Albert Einstein over the course of a number of years. And general relativity discovers a link between mass and space curvature. His suggestion is that gravity can be mimicked, if you like, locally by acceleration, and that that gravity actually does something strange, that is, mass actually does something strange to the space it is in, that we need to move out of the idea of purely Euclidean space, which is what most people think in terms of the space worked out in Euclid geometry, into some strange varieties of geometry that were worked out in the 19th century by German and Russian mathematicians. Well, general relativity leads to the concept of black holes, that you can have so much mass in a small enough area that it bends the space back on itself in such a way that light can't even escape from that object. And it leads also to the concept of the twin paradox. Let's have a quick look at each of those. Black holes is the popular name for a peculiar phenomenon that arises from general relativity. As the amount of mass in a given volume is increased, light passing near the mass begins to be more and more bent, and light coming out from the mass more and more reddened. At a certain crucial mass per volume, light cannot escape from the mass, which then becomes a black hole. The twin paradox. Imagine two twins, one of whom stays at home and the other travels out into space and back, reaching speeds close to the speed of light. Depending on how close to the speed of light the traveling twin comes, less time will have passed for him on his trip than for the twin who stayed home. This effect is not symmetrical, and all observers can distinguish between the twin who traveled and the one who didn't. The problem here you're getting is that you're now getting acceleration, and you can detect which one is accelerating and which one is not accelerating. Well, summary on relativity. Relativity theory has often been misused by unwarranted generalization. It does not teach that all ideas or worldviews are relative and of equal weight. It does teach that our ideas of simultaneity and passage of time are relative. General relativity does reinstate a possible preferred observation frame, which you lose in some sense in special relativity. And both theories have an absolute speed of light. So that's relativity, which also seems in some way to mock at common sense. But the evidence for it is quite good, it may turn out that relativity theory is wrong in some sense, but it won't turn out to be wrong in such a sense that the pre-relativistic Newtonian mechanics turns out to be the right explanation of things. We move on to our third question. The universe open or closed? What do we mean here when we talk about an open universe or a closed universe? There are two distinct uses of open and closed. with reference to the nature of the universe. One is whether anything outside the universe can penetrate it, open, or cannot, closed. And the other is whether the universe will expand forever, open, or eventually collapse, closed. The former is more common in theological discussions, the question of whether we live in a universe that, as Bultmann said, not even God can penetrate the cause and effect sequence, or the latter is more common in scientific questions, whether the universe will expand forever or whether it will eventually fall back on itself. We looked at the former use of open in our talk, The Biblical View of Nature. You should be able to find that on the IPRI website. Here we're going to look at the latter use of open, whether the universe will expand forever, open, or eventually collapsed, close. Some form of the Big Bang cosmology has now driven out its competitors, old competitor Static Universe, a more recent competitor from the 1940s, the steady state theory. Big Bang models can be classified various ways, but one way of classifying is oscillating Big Bang model. Universe expands for, say, 50 billion years, then collapses for 50 billion years, then bounces, expands, etc. That's a closed universe, okay? The universe falls back on itself. The one-bounce universe starts out very low density and gradually pulls itself together under gravitational force until it bounces and then expands again, and that's a closed universe. Also, in the no-bounce variety of the Big Bang, the version proposed first by in the 1920s by Georges Lemaître, the universe will expand forever. Well, is the universe open or closed in this sense? The oscillator model was quite popular until the early 1990s, but it now looks like the universe is expanding at an ever-increasing rate, a very surprising result. There, I think, was good evidence that the universe was expanding, but the general feeling was that it was expanding at an ever-slowing rate, and that yet it would probably still continue to expand. Both the oscillating and the one-bounce models require a bounce at the Big Bang, but it now looks like a collapsing universe would disappear into a black hole. Stephen Hawking has pointed out that the entropy of the universe appears too low for it to have been through a bounce, and thus the no bounce version or a no bounce version of the Big Bang currently fits the data best, an open universe. However, not everybody has given up and agreed that the universe had a absolute beginning and that it must have been created. The current attempts to avoid a beginning seek to have our universe be one bubble in a whole sea of bubbles. So that, yes, our particular universe had a beginning, but it's immersed in a hyper-universe you might think of that has always existed. But even in this view, our universe at least is still an open universe. Somewhere in the universe at this, currently then, the universe appears to have begun at the Big Bang. Because we are finite beings and inside our universe, we cannot rule out multiple universes, but we so far have no evidence for this. The evidence we do have strongly points toward a creation event, a creator, and a designer, and I discuss those ideas somewhat more in other PowerPoint talks. Yes, let's see, the cosmos and the Bible, I think, is one of those. Chaos theory is our last topic we want to look at here. Well, what is that all about? Chaos has been observed in the flow of fluids when they become turbulent for many years. We think of a smooth flow of fluids, what we call laminar flow, not real complicated, but the flow of fluids can become turbulent if you think about spigot or tap or faucet in your bathroom sink, for instance, and you turn it on slowly, you get kind of a nice laminar flow, if you like, but if you turn it on faster, it often becomes turbulent in some way. water flowing in a stream will sometimes be laminar out in the middle. The water seems to be flowing rather smoothly, but as it passes around rocks or something, it becomes turbulent and has whirlpools and things of that sort. Well, the differential equations for fluid flow, particularly for turbulent fluid flow, are a great mess to solve. A feature of chaos theory is what we call the butterfly effect. Back in the 50s, I believe it was, work with equations of meteorology, fluid flow, show that long-term prediction is impossible due to the nonlinear nature of the equations. And so something you may have suspected already watching your local weather forecasts is that the quality of the weather forecast degrade very badly the further in advance you try to make the predictions. Well, recent interest has been sparked by finding chaotic phenomena in numerous simple systems, one of which, rather scarily, is planetary motion, since we are in a planet traveling around a certain sort of star, and we'd be in bad shape if our orbit was modified rather drastically. Chaotic systems are physical systems in which solutions with initial conditions specified arbitrarily closely to one another, so that they're very nearly exactly the same conditions when you start the thing off, eventually diverge drastically, so that no matter how accurately one measures initial conditions, we can know virtually nothing about the state of the system once a significant period of time has passed. As I mentioned before, it looks like a weather prediction may be permanently limited to just a week or so, unless we can find some way around this problem. Summary on chaotic systems. The clearest message here is that humans are strongly limited in their ability to predict the future. This makes the evidence of fulfilled prophecy in Scripture very powerful. Some are hoping that chaotic systems will produce arbitrarily large levels of order without a designer. This appears to me to be whistling in the dark. Conclusions on recent physics. The 20th century has produced a number of real surprises. We may very well see more of these in the 21st century. Reality is nowhere near so simple as we once thought it was. If Christianity is true, we should not fear that the Bible will somehow be outdated, but we may still have to revise some of our interpretations, however. And we need to think about that, there are lots of places where we may have made an interpretation of some biblical passage or something and pressed it very hard, and it turns out we were misreading what was going on. So I think that has already happened in the question of the age of the earth, but we will have to wait and see how those things go. Well, that's the end of our talk. I doubt that we are anywhere near the end of discoveries in physics, but time will tell. For further reading, I suggest Davies and Brown, The Ghost and the Atom, 1986, a nice introduction to quantum mechanics. George Gamow, Mr. Tompkins, published back in 1940, a somewhat humorous treatment by a very competent physicist on particularly relativity. Jay Gleick, Chaos, Making a New Science, 1997. Was at least the first popular book out dealing with the whole matter of chaos theory. Stephen Hawking, A Brief History of Time, 1988, shows the problems with oscillating universe. Unfortunately, I fear that Hawking's alternative solution, which seems, as best I can read it, a universe that pops into existence without a cause, is not a great improvement. Though in fact he does discuss a lot of the data for you. Nick Herbert's book Quantum Reality, 1985, is likewise a helpful introduction to quantum mechanics, just as Davies and Brown book is. John Polkinghorne's Quantum World, 1984, is a discussion of quantum mechanics by a evangelical Christian. and Hugh Ross's Fingerprint of God, 1991, is a discussion of quantum mechanics, cosmology from the perspective of an evangelical Christian who has a doctorate in astronomy. Well, this has been a quick tour of this material, but I hope you will find it helpful.